Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeart Podcasts, and how the tech are you? So it's January 2nd, 2024, as you listen to this. It's actually back in the past, in 2023, when I record it. And we are on vacation. You know, I brought you a whole bunch of new episodes over the holidays, but I figured it's about time for Jonathan to maybe rest a little bit. So we're going to listen to a classic episode today. This episode is called Tech Stuff Enters the Singularity. I mean, after all, we're in a new year, so why not talk about the future a little bit? This was recorded way back in February 11th, 2013. Lauren Vogelbaum, now host of Brain Stuff and Saver, along with other things, was my co-host at the time. And we sat down to talk about this vision of the future, the singularity. What does it mean when we're talking about the technological singularity, that is? So sit back, relax, and enjoy this classic episode from 2013 called Tech Stuff Enters the Singularity.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Jonathan Strickland, host extraordinaire.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, host extraordinaire-ier.
That's very true. And today we wanted to talk about the future.
The future?
Yeah. Really, we're talking about a kind of a science fiction future. We're talking about the singularity. And long-time listeners to Tech Stuff, and I'm talking about folks who listened way back before we ever talked out at 30 minutes, let alone an hour, may remember that we did an episode about how Ray Kurzweil works. And Ray Kurzweil is a futurist, and one of the things he talks about extensively, particularly if you corner him at a cocktail party, is the singularity. And so we wanted to talk about what the singularity is, what this idea, you know, we really wanted to kind of dig down into it, and why is this a big deal, and how realistic is this vision of the future?
Yeah, because some people would take a little bit of would argue with your concept of it being science fiction. They take it extremely seriously.
Oh, yeah. They say it's science fact. It's science inevitability.
The term was actually coined by mathematician John von Neumann in the 1950s, but it was popularized by a science fiction writer.
Yeah, Werner Vinge.
Werner Vinge.
Yeah. It's also a... There are a lot of different concepts that are tied up together, and it all depends on upon whom you ask
right. What
it means by the singularity. For instance, there's some people who, when you hear the term the singularity, what they say is, okay, that's a time when we get to the point where technological advances are coming so quickly that it's impossible to have a meaningful conversation of what the state of technology is because it changes fast.
By the millisecond.
Right. So that's one version. But most of the versions that we're familiar with that the futurists talk about incorporate an idea of superhuman intelligence or the intelligence explosion.
Right, a kind of combination of human and technological development that just dovetails into this gorgeous, you know, space baby from 2001 kind of.
That's an excellent way of putting it. The mm-hmm. documentary 2001, I remember specifically when the space baby looked at Earth. Okay, but that documentary example doesn't work at all. It usually does, but not this time.
Yeah, not this time. Sorry, space babies are a poor example in this one instance.
But metaphorically speaking, yes, you're right on track. Because the intelligence explosion, that was a term introduced by someone known as Irving John Good, or if you want to go with his birth name, Isidore Jakob Gudak.
I can see why he changed it.
Yeah, he actually worked for a while at Bletchley Park with another fellow who made sort of a name for himself in computer science, a fellow named Alan Turing.
I guess I've heard of him.
Yeah, Turing will come up in the discussion a little bit later, but for right now, so Irving John Good, just a little quick anecdote that I thought was amusing. So Good was working with Turing to try and help break German codes. I mean, that's what Bletchley Park was all about.
Right.
So Good apparently one day drew the ire of Turing when he decided to take a little cat nap because he was tired. And it was Good's philosophy that being tired did not mean that he was not going to work at his best.
Right. So he might as well go ahead and nap.
Exactly. Take a nap, get refreshed, and then tackle the problem again, and you're more likely to solve it. Whereas Turing was very much a workhorse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was no rest. We have to do this.
On task, A-type, let's do it.
So Turing, when he discovered that Good had been napping, decided that that Good was not so good. Turing sort of treated him with disdain. He began to essentially not speak to Good. Good, meanwhile, began to think about the letters that were being used in Enigma codes to code German messages. And he began to think, what if these letters are not completely random? What if the Germans are relying on some letters more frequently than others? And he began to look at frequency of these letters being used. He made up a table
mm-hmm.
and mathematically analyzed the frequency that certain letters were used and discovered that there was a bias.
There was a pattern.
Yeah. So he said, well, with this bias, that means that we can start to narrow down the possibilities of these codes. And in fact, he was able to demonstrate that this was a way to help break German codes. And Turing, when he saw Good's work, said, I could have sworn I tried that. but clearly that showed that it worked well. And then Good, at another point, apparently went to sleep one day. And they'd been working on a code that they just could not break. And while he was sleeping, he dreamed that perhaps when the Germans were encoding this particular message, they used the letters in reverse of the way they were actually printed. And so he tried that when he woke up, and it turned out he was right. And so then his argument was, Turing, I need to go to bed.
So, yeah. What the moral of the story here is that naps are good.
Yes.
And no one should talk to you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's how I live my life. So Good's point, anyway, he came up with this term of the intelligence explosion. And it was this sort of idea that we're going to reach a point where we are increasing either our own intelligence or some sort of artificial intelligence so far beyond what we are currently capable of understanding that life as we know it will change completely. And because it's going to go beyond what we know right now, there's no way to predict what our life will be like.
Right.
Because it's beyond our
because it is, yeah, by definition, out of our comprehension.
Yes. As the Scots would say, it's beyond our ken.
Are we going to be doing accents this episode?
No, that was a terrible one. I actually regret doing it right now. I already knew I couldn't do Scottish, and yet there I went. Anyway.
You're trailblazing again.
Yeah. So to kind of backtrack a bit before we really get into the whole singularity discussion, that was just a brief overview. A good foundation to start from is the concept of Moore's Law. You know, originally Gordon Moore, who, by the way, was a co-founder of a little company called Intel.
Yeah.
He originally observed back in 1965 in a paper that I'm going to whiff this, but it was called something like cramming more components onto integrated circuits, something like that. That was actually cramming was definitely one of the words used, and circuit probably was too. Anyway, he noticed that over the course of I think originally it was 12 months, but today we consider it 2 years.
It's 18 to 24 months, I think, is the official unofficial.
Right. Yeah. That the number of discrete components on a square inch silicon wafer would double due to improvements in manufacturing and efficiency. So that, in effect, what this means to the layman is that our electronics, and particularly our computers, get twice as powerful every 2 years. So if you bought a computer in 1998 and then bought another computer in 2000, in theory, the computer in 2000 would be twice as powerful as the one from 1998. This is exponential growth.
Right.
That's an important component, this idea of exponential growth.
Right.
And it goes without saying that if you continue on this path, if this continues indefinitely, then, you know, you quickly get to computers of almost unimaginable power just a decade out.
Certainly. Although, I mean, I still don't really understand what a gigabyte means, because when I first started using computers, we were not counting in that. I mean, I was still impressed by kilobytes at the time, so.
Yeah. No, I remember the first time I got a hard drive. I think it had like a 250 megabyte hard drive, and I thought,
you're like,
who needs that much space? Now, granted, that's space we're talking about, not even processing power.
Right, absolutely.
So yeah, it's one of those things where the older you are, the more incredible today is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you start looking at computers and you think, I remember when these things came out and they were essentially the equivalent of a really good desktop calculator.
Right.
So, but Moore's Law states that this advance will continue indefinitely until we hit some sort of fundamental obstacle that we just cannot engineer our way around.
Oh, right. You know, and people, that's why it's kind of in contention right now, because people are saying that, well, there's only so much physical space that you can fit onto with silicone. There's a physical limitation to the material in which there's only so much you can do about it. And so does Moore's Law still apply if we're talking about other materials and what's, you know.
Right. And how small can you get before you start to run into quantum effects that are impossible to work around? And then do you change the geometry of a chip? Do you go three-dimensional instead of two-dimensional? Would that help?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of engineers are working on this. And frankly, pretty much every couple of years, someone says, all right, this is the year Moore's Law ends.
It's going to end.
That's it.
It's over. It's gone. It's
and then
done with.
5 years later, you're still going strong.
Yeah.
And then on the sixth year, someone else says Moore's Law is going to end.
It's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, I think, that a lot of companies attempt to
keep it going.
To keep it going.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, no one wants to be the ones to say, guys, guess what? We can't keep up with Moore's Law anymore. No one wants to do that. So it is a good motivator.
Also, if I can footnote myself real quick, I'm pretty sure that I just pronounced silicon as silicone, and I would like to state for the record that I know that those are two different substances.
Okay, that's fair.
Anyway.
I was going to ask you about it, but by the time you were finished talking, I thought, let's just go.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's all right. If you knew how many times I have used that particular pronunciation to hilarious results.
Excellent.
So moving on with this whole idea about Moore's Law, I mean, the reason this plays into the singularity is with the technological advances, you start to be able to achieve pretty incredible things. And even within one generation of Moore's Law, which is kind of a meaningless term, but let's say you arbitrarily pick a date, and then 2 years from that date you look and see what's possible with the new technology, and getting to twice as much power, however you want to define it, doesn't necessarily mean that you've only doubled the amount of things you can do with that power. You may have limitless things you can do. So with that idea, you're talking about being able to power through problems way faster than you did before. And there's lots of different ways of doing that. For example, grid computing. Grid computing is when you are linking computers together to work on a problem all at once. Now, this works really well with certain problems, parallel problems we call them.
Mm-hmm.
These are problems where there are lots of potential solutions, and each computer essentially is working on one set of potential solutions. And that way you have all these different computers working on it at the same time. It reduces the overall time it takes to solve that parallel problem. And so, if you've ever heard of anything like Folding at Home or the SETI project,
mm-hmm.
where you could dedicate your computer's idle time. So the idle processes, the processes that are not being used while you're surfing the web or writing how the singularity works or, building an architectural program in some sort of CAD application, anything that you're not using can be dedicated to one of these projects. Same sort of idea in that you don't necessarily have to build a supercomputer to solve complex problems if you use a whole bunch of computers. A
whole bunch of small ones,
yeah.
Right.
Large Hadron Collider does this, although they use very nice advanced computers, but they do a lot of grid computing as well.
Sure.
So just using those kind of models, we see that we're able to do much more sophisticated things than we could
otherwise, if we were, certainly. Yes, networks, as it turns out, are pretty cool.
Yeah, and networks play a part in this idea of the singularity. Actually, I guess now is a good time. We'll kind of transition into Werner Vinge's, I don't know how to say his last name. I say Vinge, and it could end up being Vinge. But
I just went with what you said, so that's great.
That's fine.
Let's do it.
We'll say that Vinge says everything is silicone. So Werner, though, he suggested four different potential pathways that humans could take, or really that the world could take, to arrive at the technological singularity.
Okay. What are they?
The four ways are we could develop a superhuman artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So computers suddenly are able to think on a level that's analogous to the way humans think and can do it better than
but
we
better,
can.
But better, right.
Yeah. Whether or not that means computers are conscious, that's debatable. We'll get into that, too. Computer networks could somehow become self-aware. That's number two.
Okay.
So
Skynet.
Skynet. So sure. like the grid computing we were just talking about, that somehow using these grid computers, the network itself,
having enough cycles and enough pathways and enough loops back around, it starts going like, hey, I recognize this.
Yeah.
And starts thinking about
like thinking about IBM's Watson, but it's distributed across a network. So computers, you could think of computers as all being super powerful neurons in a brain, and that mm-hmm. the network is actually neural pathways.
Okay.
And it's definitely a science fiction-y way of looking at things. Doesn't mean it won't happen.
But sure. But Stranger Things, my friends.
It feels like a Matrix kind of thing to me. Then we have the idea that computer-human interfaces are so advanced and so intrinsically tied to who we are that humans themselves evolve beyond being human. We become transhuman.
Okay.
So this is an idea that we almost merge with computers, at least on some level.
Via kind of nanobot technology, you know,
yeah.
like stuff running through our bloodstream, stuff in our neural cells.
Yep. Or we have just brain interfaces where our consciousness.
Yeah.
Our consciousness is connected to. So for example, we might have it where instead of connecting to the internet via some device like a smartphone or a computer.
Uh-huh. An external device.
Yeah, it's right there in our meat brains. So that, you know, you're sitting there having a conversation with someone, then you're like, oh, wait, what movie was that guy in? Let me just look up IMDb in my brain. And then you, depending on how good your connection is. which means, by the way, if you are a journalist and you attend CES, you will automatically be dumber because all the internet connectivity will be taken up. And so you'll be sitting there trying to ask good questions and drool will come out of your mouth, which to me is a typical CES.
I can only assume that wireless technology would advance also at this point. But
one can only hope.
Fingers crossed.
There are certain technologies that are not advancing at the exponential rate of Moore's Law, which is another problem. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And then the fourth and final method that Werner had suggested the world may go would be that humans would advance so far in biological sciences that it would allow us to engineer human intelligence so that we could make ourselves as smart as we wanted to be. This is sort of that Gattaca future where we've got all the another great documentary where we engineer ourselves to be super smart.
Right.
So those are the four pathways. Artificial intelligence, computer networks become self-aware, computer-human interfaces become really, really awesome, or we have biologically engineered human intelligence. And all four of these lead to a similar outcome, which is this intelligence explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the idea that some form of superhuman intelligence is created, either artificially or within ourselves, and that at that point, we will no longer be able to predict what our world will be like, because by definition, we will have a superhuman intelligent entity involved. And because that's superhuman, it's beyond our ability to predict.
Right.
Which is, you know.
Which makes thought experiments about it a little bit
philosophical.
Yeah.
That's the kind way of putting it. Pointless would be another way of putting it. Like we could you know, sit there and spitball a whole bunch of possible futures, but that's the thing. They're possible. We don't know which one could come out. We don't even know if these four pathways are inevitable. We have futurists who truly believe that this is something that will happen at some point. There are other people who are more skeptical, but we'll talk about them in a bit. So one of the outcomes that Werner was talking about, and it's a fairly popular one in futurist circles, is the idea of the robo-apocalypse, essentially.
Right, right.
This is where you've got the humans are bad, destroy all humans mm-hmm. idea. Essentially, the idea is that humans would become extinct, either through definition because we've evolved into something else
mm-hmm.
or because whatever the superhuman intelligence is, it decides we are a problem.
Yeah, and a lot of futurists are a lot more positive about that. They're more looking forward to it than being scared of it. It's less of a, oh no, big scary robots are coming to take over our society, and more of a, robots are coming to take over our society. Yeah. Like, free day, yay!
Yeah, exactly. I don't have to work anymore, and I don't – because robots are supplying all the things we need – there's no need for anyone to work anymore. There's no need for money anymore because the only reason you need money is so you can buy stuff.
Yeah.
But if everything's free, then you don't need – so it becomes Star Trek and we all, you know
– run around in jumpsuits and
– right. Punch people. And if you're Kirk, you make out a lot. I mean a lot. That dude every week. Picard and Riker, if you add them together, make one Kirk.
In this documentary series.
Yeah.
Star Trek.
Yeah. I don't know about Archer because I never watched Enterprise, so you guys have to get back to me on that.
Yeah, sorry about that. That is also a gap in my personal understanding.
I just took one look at that decontamination chamber and I said, "Yep, I'm out." Anyway, so that's Werner Vinge. He sort of popularized this idea, but there are other people who have kind of, I think their names are synonymous with it, and we will talk about them in just a minute.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
And now back to the show. So Werner Vinge, again, very much associated with the idea of the singularity, but there's another name that comes up all the time, Ray Kurzweil.
Ray Kurzweil. And this is a fellow who has been referred to in various circles as the Thomas Edison of modern technology, or perhaps more colorfully, the Willy Wonka of technology. That was by Jeff Duncan of Digital Trends, and I just wanted to shout out because that was great.
Nice. You get nothing. I shared a remix of Willy Wonka earlier today, and it's still playing through my head.
We're fans. We might be fans of the Gene Wilder Willy Wonka. Everyone, homework assignment. Go watch that. It has nothing to do with
the singularity.
The singularity at all.
I don't know. There's some chocolate singularity in there.
Chocolate singularity. I want to do
That's
an episode
a
on that.
For a band.
If I were better at cover band names, I totally would have said something witty right there.
Yeah. All right. Well, fair enough. We'll say it's the Archies. For sugar, sugar.
Oh, dear. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Ray Kurzweil is the kind of cat who, you know, when he was in high school, invented a computer program. And this is in the mid-1960s. This isn't like last year or something. In the mid-1960s, created a computer program that listened to classical music, found patterns in it, and then created new classical music based on that.
So it was a computer that composed classical music.
Yes.
Following the rules of classical music that other composers had created.
Yes.
That's kind of cool.
That's just something he did, you know. And
yeah, dude's got credentials.
Yeah. He also kind of invented flatbed scanners.
Wow.
Has
cool.
done a whole bunch of stuff in speech recognition.
Yeah.
And
which, that's interesting because, we'll talk about that in a second, but one of Kurzweil's big points is that he thinks that by – and this all depends upon which interview you read of Kurzweil. But in various interviews, he said that essentially by 2030, we will reach a point where we will be able to make an artificial brain.
Right.
We'll have reverse engineered the brain and we'll be able to create an artificial one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of debate – in smarter circles than the ones I move in, that's not a slap against my friends. They're pretty bright, but none of us are neurologically gifted at that point.
Sure.
I include myself in that circle. So, but there's some very bright people who debate about this point, whether or not we'll be able by the year 2030 to reverse engineer the brain and design an artificial one. And I think the debate is not so much on whether or not we'll have the technological power necessary to simulate a brain.
Sure.
I mean, we can simulate brains on a certain superficial level today.
Well, I mean, hypothetically, we could connect enough computers that we could make it go.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, we could probably get the computer horsepower, especially by 2030, to simulate a human brain. The question is whether we will understand the human brain enough
to do so.
Exactly.
Sure.
So that's sort of where the debate lies. It's not so much on the technological side of things as it is the biological side of things, which is kind of interesting. I've read a lot of critics who have really jumped on Kurzweil for this, particularly P.Z. Myers has written some pretty
acerbic.
Yeah, strongly worded criticisms to Kurzweil's theories, saying that that Kurzweil simply does not understand neurological development and activities, and that, you know, the nature between the environment and our the way our brains develop over time versus the, you know, nurture versus nature, all of this stuff with the hormonal changes, the electrochemical reactions.
Yeah, saying that there's so many little bits that make up our brains, so many hormones, so many processes, and we understand such a small fraction of what they do. This is why a lot of psychiatric drugs, for example, are kind of like, oh, well, we invented this thing and we guess it does this thing.
Right.
Take it and see what happens.
Right.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah, we don't – it tends to make you happy. It also makes you perceive the color red as having the smell of oranges. Like, you know, we don't understand it fully. And in fact, there are other people like Stephen Novella, who is, he's the author of the Neurological blog, and he also is a host on a wonderful podcast called Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. If you guys haven't listened to that, you should try that out, especially if you like skepticism and critical thinking. But he's a doctor and a proponent of evidence-based medicine, and he talks about how we don't know how much we don't know about the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have no way of knowing where the endpoint is as far as the brain is concerned, and therefore we cannot guess at how long it will take us to reverse engineer it, simply because we don't know where the finish line is.
Right, right. Yeah. Kurzweil has a new book, new as of we're recording this in January 2013. It just came out in November of 2012, called How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. And in the book, he theorizes that, okay, if you'll follow me for a second, atoms are tiny bits of data.
Okay.
DNA is a form of a program. The nervous system is a computer that coordinates bodily functions, and thought is kind of simultaneously a program and the data that that program contains.
Gotcha. See, now this is another problem that some scientists have.
Yeah.
Is reducing the human brain to the model of a computer.
Right. Because it's a very elegant, interesting proposition.
Sure.
And it's kind of sexy like that, because you go like, oh, well, that sort of makes sense, man. Like, let's go get a pizza and talk about this more.
Yeah, let me get a program that will allow me to suddenly know all kung fu.
Right. Like, and when you're a programmer, that's a great plan.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That sounds terrific. But yeah, there's one specific guy I found, Jaron Lanier, wrote a terrific thing called One Half of a Manifesto, which is a really entertaining read if you guys like this kind of thing, wherein he was saying that what futurists are talking about when they talk about the singularity is basically a religion. He was calling it cybernetic totalism, like a fanatic ideology. He compares it to Marxism at some point. Because,
interesting.
Yeah. And he was saying that you know, it's this theory is a terrific theory. If you want to get into the philosophy of who we are and what we do and what technology is, but that, you know, cybernetic patterns aren't necessarily the best way to understand reality, and that they're not necessarily the best model for how people work, for how culture works, for how intelligence works, and that saying so is a gross oversimplification.
That's a good point. And we should also point out that it all depends on how you define intelligence as well, because Kurzweil himself has worded his own predictions in such a way that some would argue, Novella argues, for example, that he has given himself enough room where he's going to be right no matter what. Like
mm-hmm.
saying that by 2030 we will be able to reverse engineer basic brain functions. And Novella says, well,
sure.
Technically you could argue that now. So
uh-huh.
That kind of gives you a lot of room.
A little bit of a gimme there.
Yeah. But whether or not it means total brain function, that's a totally different question. And so the other point is that we could theoretically create an artificial intelligence that does not necessarily reverse engineer the brain. It doesn't follow the human intelligence model. I mean, that's IBM's Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a good example of artificial intelligence that, you know, it in some ways it mimics the brain, because it kind of has to. You know, we're coming at this. Human beings are the ones creating this technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so as human beings creating this technology, it's going to follow the rules that as we understand them. So there's going to be some
right.
mimicry there.
Right.
But IBM's Watson, you know, you think about that. It doesn't really understand necessarily the data that's passing through it. It's looking for the connections and
right.
making judgments.
It's really savvy at making connections and recognizing patterns and spitting out useful information.
Yeah. It's looking for whatever answer is most likely the right one.
Mm-hmm.
It's all probability based, right?
Sure.
So, and if it doesn't reach a certain threshold, it doesn't provide the answer.
Sure.
So if, arbitrarily speaking, I don't know what the threshold is, so I'm just making a number.
Mm-hmm.
85%. Let's say it has to be 85% certain or higher for it to give that answer. If the certainty falls below that threshold, no answer is given. That's essentially how it worked when Watson was on Jeopardy.
Right, right.
It would analyze the answer in Jeopardy terms, and then come up with what it thought was probably the most accurate question for that answer. And occasionally it was wrong to hilarious results. But it did sort of seem to kind of mimic the way humans think, at least on a superficial level. And
The thing about humans is that they're wrong a lot more than what, that 15% of the time or something. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, we've got,
well, we give answers even if we're not 85% sure of the question.
Of course.
I certainly do,
as we all know from going to trivia nights.
And there's
a lot of I've read a lot online about arguments of how our deficiencies, our memory biases, our irrational behavior, our weird hormonal stuff going on are what make us human, and that you can't teach a computer to be irrational.
That's true. Although you can teach it to swear.
You can.
We read a story last week. Yeah, where IBM allowed Watson to read the Urban Dictionary, and then Watson got a little bit of a potty mouth.
It got kind of fresh.
It did. It started to say that, what was it? Oh, I'm going to say something, and it's going to be bleeped out, right, Tyler? Mm-hmm. Tyler just said, mm-hmm. So there's one point where a researcher asked a question of Watson, and Watson included within the answer the word bull. So since that was bleeped out, you probably don't know what it was. So go look it up. It was funny.
It was really funny. Yes. And then they basically nuked that part of Watson from orbit. They were like, you know what? Never mind.
It was the only way to be sure. They wiped out the Urban Dictionary from Watson's memory. They also said that a very similar thing happened when they let Watson read Wikipedia.
Oh, no.
No judgments here, just saying what IBM said. Anyway, again, the computer was unable to determine when it
was appropriate.
Yeah, what's the appropriate context for dropping a swear word?
Yeah.
It didn't know, so it just started to speak kind of like my wife does. So, it was I'm going to pay for that later. That's an interesting point, though. Again, you're showing how machine intelligence and human intelligence are different, because the machine intelligence doesn't have that context, right?
Sure. And of course, you know, we're talking about science fiction or science future, however you want to term it, so that, you know, we might very well come up with a fancy little program script that lets you introduce that kind of bias.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah.
But again, from that documentary Star Trek, I mean, Data never figured out those contractions.
That's true.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Turing actually had a great mental exercise, really. And it's called the Turing test. And this applies to artificial intelligence. Turing's point, and we've talked about the Turing test in previous episodes of Tech Stuff, but just as a refresher, Turing had suggested that you could create a test and that if a machine could pass that test at the same level as a human, in other words, if you were unable to determine that the person who took that test was human or machine, the machine had passed the Turing test and had essentially simulated human intelligence. And it usually works as an interview. So you have someone who's conducting an interview, and you have either a machine answering or a human answering. Mm-hmm. And there's a barrier up so that, of course, the person asking the questions cannot see who is responding. And, of course, they're responding through, you know, text usually, because if they're responding through a voice, and it's like, I think the answer is four. You know, you'd be like, well, either it's a robot or the most boring person in the world. The idea being you would ask these questions over a computer monitor, get text responses, and if you were unable to answer with a certain degree of accuracy whether or not it was a machine or a person, then you would say the machine passed the Turing test. And you could argue, well, that could just mean that the machine's very good at mimicking human intelligence. It does not actually possess human intelligence. Mm-hmm. Turing's point is, does that matter? Because I know that I am intelligent. I speak with someone like Lauren, who I assume is also intelligent based upon the responses she gives, but she could just be simulating intelligence. However, I have already bestowed in my mind the feature of intelligence upon Lauren because what she does is very much akin to what I do. So Turing said, if you extend the courtesy to your fellow human being that they are intelligent based on the fact that they act like you do, why would you not do the same thing for a machine? Does it matter if the machine can actually think? If the machine simulates thought well enough for it to pass as human, then you're giving it the same benefit of doubt as you would anyone else you meet.
Right, right. This is what a lot of science fiction movies are about, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot of philosophy in this.
Yeah, a lot of philosophy, a lot of Isaac Asimov, a lot of Blade Runner.
And
that's not an author, sorry.
Well, no, but, you know, Philip K. Dick, look him up. Yeah. So anyway,
thank you.
Do androids dream of electric sheep? I won't spoil it for you. To kind of wrap this all up, getting back into the discussion of philosophy, we had very recently, we did a podcast about, are we living in a computer simulation?
Right, right.
And that kind of plays into this idea of the singularity, because that argument stated that if the singularity is in fact possible, if it's inevitable, if we are going to reach this level of transhumanism where we are no longer able to really predict what the present will be like because it'll be beyond our understanding, then one thing we would expect to do is create simulations of our past to kind of study ourselves.
Sure.
Right?
And to see what happens, play around with variables.
Yeah.
We like good experiments.
Yeah. And we could, if we're that advanced, we could, in theory, create such a realistic simulation that the inhabitants of that simulation would be incapable of knowing that they were artificial and would be completely,
oblivious.
Self-aware of themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, that was totally redundant. Self-aware, but unable to know that they were a simulation. And he said that if those things are possible, then there's no way of knowing that. You know, the overwhelming possibility is that we are in fact a
computer simulation right now.
Because if that's what's going to happen, then there's no way of saying with certainty that we are not in fact the product of that. And so, the point being not necessarily that we are, in fact, living in a computer simulation, but that perhaps this singularity, this transhumanism thing, might not be realistic.
Right.
It might not be the future that we're headed to. Maybe it ends up being a pipe dream that's not really possible for us to attain, or maybe we'll wipe ourselves out through some terrible war or catastrophic accident. Maybe we create a biological entity that wipes us out, a la the Stand.
Right, right.
Or we create a black hole at the LHC, which, come on, people, don't write me. I already know about that and how tiny and almost non-existent they are because
it
they last
happen.
So quickly.
It could right, totally fine. Happen.
Let's say that they do that thing where you look at that one website where the black hole forms in the parking lot outside the LHC and you just see the whole picture go which funny video. Anyway, that argument plays back into this. So I don't know. I don't know if we're going to ever see a future where the singularity becomes a thing. Oh, and we never really talked about it. But one of the big points that Kurzweil really punches in his singularity talks is the idea of digital immortality.
Right, right. And he's been obsessed with this. And obsessed is probably a judgmental word. I apologize. But he's been very focused on this concept. His father died when he was about 24. And he's been exploring theories on life extension ever since then, and supposedly takes all kinds of supplements and sells them as well to extend life, has all kinds of health plans.
Yeah, dietary plans that he has, exercise, all this. The idea that the idea being that if he can preserve his own life.
If he can only last long enough that we hit the singularity, then he can become immortal.
Right. And either that, you know, we attain immortality through one of a thousand different ways. For example, we end up uploading our own intelligence into the cloud.
Right.
And then we become part of a group consciousness. So mm-hmm. we are no longer really individuals. Or we merge with computers in some other way so that we are technically immortal that way. Or we just conquer the genes that all guide the aging process and we stop it.
And we stop disease. You know, we take, like in Transmet, you just take a cancer pill and then you don't get cancer because that's what you do.
Yeah. So again, the singularity, that's kind of why I think a lot of critics also point to it as being more of a religion, because it's kind of this sort of utopian pipe dream in their minds.
There's the former CEO of Lotus, Mitch Kapper, I'm not sure how you say it, once called it the intelligent design for the IQ 140 people.
Yeah. Ouch.
Ouch.
Meanwhile, Kurzweil's kind of laughing all the way to the bank. I hear that a company that rhymes with Schmoogle hired him.
Little people. I mean, you probably wouldn't have heard of him.
Yeah.
But yeah, they just hired him on to be, I have it in my notes, the official title. I think it's the director of engineering.
Yeah.
A director of engineering over there.
Yeah. They get some big names. I mean, they had Vint Cerf as the chief evangelist. And of course, he was one of the fathers of the internet. So Google's got a... they're known for getting some really smart people. And to be fair, while the singularity may or may not ever happen, I think it's important that we have optimists in the field of technology who are really pushing for our development to try and make the world a better place for people. Now, you know.
Oh, absolutely. So even if we never reach the point of digital immortality in our lifetimes or any other, if someone wants to think so big that they want to put nanobots to make my body awesomer, I mean, and not that came out possibly crude. I mostly means that I don't get cancer and die, kind of stuff. That's terrific. I can't argue with any part of that.
Yeah, I'm going to be on video so much this year that I definitely need my body to be awesomer. So I'm all for that.
Well, either way, yes. And Google, you know, Google looks forward so much to augmented reality. I'm sorry. I can't pronounce anything today. I am on a non-roll.
It's okay.
And the Internet of Things and all of that wonderful future tech that it seems like a terrific fit.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, obviously the nice thing about this is that all we have to do is live long enough to see it happen or not happen. And most predictions have the singularity hitting somewhere between 2030 and 2050.
So we'll find out.
Yeah, it all depends upon which futurist you're asking. And also, it's one of those rolling goalposts as well.
Right.
You know how certain technologies are always 20 years away or 5 years away or 10 years away? So we'll see. Maybe by 2020 we'll be saying, all right, we've revised our figures.
By 2070, yeah. Definitely.
But who knows? We'll see. Guys, if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, well, here's what you can do. You can write us an email. And a lot of people have been asking about our email address. I do say it at every episode. But in case you've missed it, listen carefully. Our email address is techstuff@discovery.com. Send an email. I'll prove it by writing back. Or drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there, both of those, is techstuffhsw. And Lauren and I will talk to you again in the future.
And that was the classic episode, Tech Stuff Enters the Singularity, way back from 2013, more than a decade ago. Holy cats, I have been doing this show for so long, because Lauren, of course, was my second co-host. I had already done a couple hundred shows with a different co-host. Wow, really does hit me right in the brain. So I hope you all enjoyed that. I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next. I don't think we're going to hit the singularity this year. Maybe I should have put that as one of my predictions, but who knows? Maybe OpenAI is going to create the next generative chat bot and it'll program the
Skynet-like system that will bring us onto the singularity kicking and screaming. Or if you're me, I'm probably already kicking and screaming just because I'm grouchy. Anyway, I hope you're all well. I hope you had a happy and safe new year, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.